We're going to finish up Ezekiel 36 or 37 this morning. I was going to jump into Ezekiel 38, but Ezekiel 38 and 39 are really controversial. Not in a bad way, I mean in a good way, but I need to take them both as wholes, and because some of the interpretation for 38 is in 39. Anyway, I won't bore you with all that. We'll talk about it next week. But I wanted not to be finishing off one chapter and try to jump into the next chapter and only like basically barely introduce it to you. I wanted to be able to give you the whole. Okay? So Ezekiel chapter 37, and we'll finish today. We've just got a few verses left at the end of 37. Oh boy. Okay. Hey Ron, could you go to the kitchen and get me a glass of water, please? I know Tiffany is busy with a newborn, and so she always has me a glass of water up here, bless her heart. So Ron will become my Tiffany this morning. So don't tell Ron, okay? Don't tell Ron what I just said, okay? So we'll leave that alone. So what's that, Ron? Yeah, without a doubt, that's true too. So I think the offense probably goes both ways. So Seth, what goes to church stays at church, okay? So you're not. Oh, she edits the video. Oh no, I'm in deep trouble now. So I understand. So I mentioned this last week about Leah and Rachel. You remember we talked about in verse 18. What's so exciting for this prophecy is that by the time this is being written, you know, 585, 584, whatever that time frame, the nation split about 930, 940. So it's been split for almost 400 years, for 350 years. So the northern 10 and the southern 10 have, southern 2 had split. The northern 10 tribes, thank you, I won't say all the mean things I said about you when you went out. So they split, and this is like 585. The northern 10 tribes went into captivity 140 years before, roughly, in 722. So this idea of Israel being all back together again, it's like when a family has, you know, the brothers and siblings fight, or the cousins and nephews fight, and they don't talk to each other for 20 years, and then they get back together, and it's a spiritual experience. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. Oh, and they hug, and I mean, what a joyous thing that is. When a marriage has, maybe they've gone through divorce, and I've gotten to have the privilege of counseling them, and they get remarried, and they apologize to each other for either infidelity or whatever was going on that drove them apart, and they hug, and they cry, and they weep in my office. I mean, the joy is unspeakable. I can't even describe to you what that joy looks like, right? When I've been able to facilitate some of that in my ministry. What this is like the family coming back together. I mean, we were killing each other and murdering each other and stabbing each other for hundreds of years. And what Jeremiah or Ezekiel is prophesying is, in the future, there's going to be one stick. There's not going to be a Leah stick and a Rachel stick. It's going to be one stick. And we see in verse 18, chapter 37, he says, "And when the children of your people speak to you, will you not show us what you mean by these?" He says, "I'm going to bring the stick of Joseph." That's in verse 19, which is in the hand of Ephraim. Remember, Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And remember, Levi was taken out of the 12 and became a priest. Joseph got two tribes. Remember, Joseph gets two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. Levi is taken out of the 12 and becomes priests. And they're spread out all over Israel, right, in different cities to teach the people. Joseph actually gets this double blessing. Joseph's mom is who? Rachel. Judah's mom is who? Leah. Did Rachel and Leah get along? No. My wife, who comes from a family where her dad had four wives, not because he was Mormon, he had them in succession, right? He had wife number one, wife number two, wife number three, her mom is wife number three. She has a half-sister by wife number one. She has a half-sister by wife number two. She has three full brothers by her mother, and she's the youngest of those four. And then when her dad had another affair and married the fourth wife, she had three daughters from a previous marriage. So my wife has two half-sisters, three full brothers, and three stepsisters. And to make it more confusing, one of her full brothers married one of her half-sisters. So her full brother married his half-sister. I'm sorry, stepsister, not by blood, because it's the younger, so it's not an immoral thing, but a brother married a stepsister. So you can imagine what Father's Day was like. You imagine what Thanksgiving was like. And my wife's comment has always been when we've talked about Joseph and Leah and Rachel, and there's four wives there too. And she says it is not natural because the kids all have issues with each other as adults. They've had them for years. I mean, horrible things. And my wife says it's not natural for a man to have multiple wives and multiple children by multiple women. That's not God's intent. And there are consequences when we do that. Right? Okay? The sibling rivalry, that's 1850 BC. We're now in this prophecy 585 BC. So it's 1300 years later, and Ezekiel is promising that Leah's kids and Joseph, Leah's kids and Rachel's kids under the Messiah's rule are going to come back together, and it's going to be a great family reunion and put away thousands of years of animosity within the family. What a great prophecy, huh? What a great prophecy. So, as I said in the notes as we finished last week, Leah is the mother of Judah and Rachel the mother of Joseph, who was the father of Ephraim, or the dominant tribe of the north. I'm in my notes. Some of the sons of Jacob were by the handmaids of each Leah and Rachel, but Judah and Joseph are by the two wives. They represent the north and the south of the divided kingdom. So this, it's not only that we're going to be restored and have a great kingdom, but we're going to be together as a family again. Wow, what a great prophecy. Verse 21, then say to them, thus saith the Lord God, surely I will take the children of Israel from among the nations, wherever they have gone. Now remember when he's prophesying this, some of them are in Egypt, handful of less are left in Judah. Some are in Babylon. The northern 10 tribes are spread through all of northern Iraq, northern Syria, modern day Turkey. They're spread all over more northern, up into what we would call Armenia, the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea. They're spread all over the place. And he's saying they're all going to come back together again. And he says, verse 22, and he says he will bring them into their own land. Verse 21, remember the prophecies are always about a king and a land. So when I give you an interpretation that we call a dispensational interpretation or a premillennial interpretation as opposed to an amillennial, my amillennial friends will say, oh, Israel sinned so much. Church has replaced Israel. It's called the replacement theory. The church has replaced Israel. And so all these promises that we're reading right now about a kingdom and a land and Joseph and Judah coming back together, you know, that's all spiritualized in the church. It's not literal. That's not literally going to happen. Because we would say this is going to happen when? During the millennium. This is a millennial. This is when Christ rules and reigns. Revelation chapter 19, right? Revelation chapter 20 after the Battle of Armageddon, which we're going to be talking about next week in Ezekiel 37 and 38, that's that prophecy. So they would say, oh no, these are all spiritualized. I just have to keep pounding this drum. Why would God make these prophecies that the people that receive them in their distress, they're in distress. These are prophecies of encouragement, right? These are prophecies to say, God's got this. He hasn't abandoned you. He loves you. You've sinned, but he's not forgotten you. He made a covenant with you, right? Isn't that, this is not, hey, by the way, you've sinned so much, God's going to throw you out and the church is going to get these promises. That's not encouraging. That's not encouraging to these Jews that are in captivity. These are prophecies of encouragement. Yes, and they're encouragement to us. Because if God hasn't forgotten Israel, God hasn't forgotten you. If God forgets Israel, God can forget you. These are great encouragement because God will keep His word. That's what He's saying. That's our encouragement. And we can disagree about the exact timing of what a battle is on God's timeline, but the overarching encouragement is God's not going to forget Israel, so therefore God's not going to forget me and you. I can't sin enough for God to forget me. Now, He will convict me. He will chasten me just like He is Israel. So it's not like, I can do whatever I want and God won't forget me. Oh, no. Let me tell you something. My parents never forgot me when I got out of line. They always remembered me. Mike, come here. Sit down. Lay across my knee. My parents never forgot me. There were a lot of times I wish my parents forgot me. Did you ever wish your parents had forgotten who you were a couple of times in your life? Yeah. Yeah. My parents never forgot me. He said, they shall not, verse 23, they shall not defile themselves anymore with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions, but I will deliver them from all their dwelling places. That is why I do not believe Ezekiel 37 is fully fulfilled today in Israel. That's why I call it an embryonic fulfillment. It's starting the fulfillment because they're back in the land after almost 2,000 years. But according to this prophecy, they're going to put away their detestable sin, things, their transgressions. Well, Israel, modern Judaism in Israel, and secular Jews for sure have not put away their idols and detestable things, right? They're just like secular people in the United States, right? I mean, they are. So this can't be now because of what God's prophecy is. It's the beginning of the prophecy. As my dad would say, God is moving the chess pieces on the chessboard to get them in place for checkmate on Satan. This is all God moving the pawns around to checkmate Satan. You know what chess is? Okay. I saw blank looks. I'm like, okay, I'm not using a sports analogy, so somebody other than Gene ought to know what I'm talking about. So, and he says, they have sinned and I will cleanse them. They shall be my people and I will be their God. What a great promise. Verse 28 in my notes, I say, verse 21, the interpretation is very clear. In the future, God was going to bring all Israel back together and they were living because of their sin. Oh, I fat fingered that one. They were living because of their sin. It should be where they were living because of their sin. I missed where they were living. I said they were living where instead of the were. Okay. He was going to give them their land back and give them one king and rule over them. That's the next part of it. The promise is forever. This means it can't have been fulfilled by the Maccabees before Christ's first coming. He will create peace for them and it will be everlasting. These promises give a foreshadow of the physical structure God will give them found in Ezekiel at 40 to 43. An even further explanation of the prophecy is when we get to Ezekiel 40 to 43, God gives exact dimensions of the future temple in the millennium. And it's much larger than Solomon's, and it's way bigger than Herod's. Well, what would be the purpose of God writing multiple chapters on the dimensions of a future temple if it never was going to happen and it was just going to be spiritualized? Are you tracking with me? Does that make sense? Why would God go to all that? That makes no sense at all. And notice what he says in verse 24. David, my servant, shall be king over them. Well, obviously, David had been dead for almost 500 years. Okay, so it's David's, it's the promised Messiah, right? It's Jesus. David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd, so it won't be divided. They shall walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. Then they shall dwell in the land. Remember, it's a land with a king. You can't have a kingdom without a king and land. So when you spiritualize this, it's not really a kingdom. When you say, oh, it's a spiritual kingdom. Really? Well, then why does God keep saying land, land, land? It's got to be land. There's land involved. He says, and I have given to Jacob, my servant, where your fathers dwell. That's why the modern Jew often sees the state of Israel, the secular Jew sees the state of Israel as the Messiah, not a literal Jesus. So they're in the land. That's why they want all the land that their fathers dwelt in, including what we would call today the West Bank. It's the land. They look at this and go, we have all these promises from 2,500 years ago. This is our land. And the state of Israel, our war machines, our defense industry, that's our Messiah. So he says, where your fathers dwell, they and their children and their children's children forever. So this also can't be the Maccabees because they were kicked out of the land. This is forever. When this promise happens, when the millennium happens, the Jews have the land forever. Forever. He says, my servant David shall be their prince forever. Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them, and it shall be an everlasting covenant with them. I will establish them and multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. We're going to see that when we get to Ezekiel 40, 41, and 42. We're going to see this sanctuary that is going to be during the millennium. Sanctuary forever. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Indeed, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. It sounds a lot like Revelation 21. I will be their God, and I will be their people. John is hearkening back to this. And he's saying the church is going to be present during the millennium as well. And the eternal state. But it doesn't supplant. It's different from being with as opposed to supplanting. Does that make sense? Okay. My tabernacle shall be with them. Indeed, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. The nations also will know that I, the Lord, sanctify Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. When I get to it, and I mentioned this a couple of years ago when I preached on that passage really quickly in Ezekiel 40, a lot of people ask, well, why would there be a temple if Jesus is ruling and reigning in person? Why will there be a temple in the millennium? Oh, we'll talk about that. That's a really good question. So it's the trailer for coming attractions. But we've got to get through all the bloodshed of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which will start next week. We don't get the peace and the temple until we checkmate the Antichrist. So...